Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Today's video is brought to you by Carrie Black, author of Sometimes Illness Wins, A Guide to Understanding and Living with Grief. I'm going to warn you up front that the ad gets a bit personal and serious, but the main video is on the sillier side today, so if the ad gets you down, I hope I'll be able to pick you back up afterwards. Hello and welcome to my channel, Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video from CARM. No, not the CBSA Assessment Revenue Management System, which is what you'll find if you Google CARM, bold choice of them to have one of the letters of their acronym be an initialism, but rather Matt Slick's Christian Apologetics and Research Ministry. And yeah, those of you who are familiar with Matt Slick will be groaning in pain right now, but when I discovered the CBSA thing, I stumbled across a little detail that might end up with me believing in curses. Because one of the most annoying things about responding to Matt Slick's videos is that so many of them only have sound on the left channel, so either I end up with a headache as my brain tries to understand why someone is only talking to me in one ear, or I have to fix their video for them before I even start. Well, the first video that I clicked on for the CBSA CARM thing also only had sound out the left channel.
They're introducing an initiative called CARM, C-A-R-M, CBSA's Assessment Revenue Management System.
So maybe the acronym CARM is just cursed to cause people who use it to not know how to do basic sound-related stuff with their videos. Anyway, in this video, Matt talks about how atheism fails to account for morality, so let's take a look. But first, a word from our sponsor. Sometimes Illness Wins, A Guide for Understanding and Living with Grief by Carrie Black. When author Carrie Black faced the passing of her daughter, well-meaning people tried so hard to help by giving her books on grieving, but nothing she found was just right. So she wrote a book that she wished existed, Sometimes Illness Wins. It's an illustrated book for all ages about navigating the loss of someone special. Written with the distraught brain in mind, it's an entry-level distillation of available information about the grieving process, what to expect, and what can help. Everyone in my house got a copy of it when Mrs. Rhino passed away, so everyone could make their own notes in it, write their own thoughts and feelings, but reading it together was also a bonding experience. I love that it strongly reinforces the fact that everybody grieves differently, and that that is okay. Because one of the hardest parts of grieving is feeling like your thoughts or emotions are inappropriate to the situation. Reading it together with my kids was really helpful in making sure that they felt safe and loved while expressing themselves in their own unique ways. Everyone grieves differently, so the book approaches grief from a general perspective, but it includes sections where you can fill in details that are specific to your situation. If you or someone you love is going through the grieving process, this book is the perfect accompaniment to well wishes and a thoughtful listener. Sometimes Illness Wins is available for less than the price of a bouquet of flowers. Many readers have found it worthwhile to have extra copies on hand to share with friends and family as the need arises. Grief often comes without warning. Sometimes Illness Wins is grounded in secular, evidence-based best practice, and it's both for adults and children. It's written without appeal to religion or superstition. It turns out that once in a while, the book that the world needs would never make the bestseller list, so here it is filling in the gaps. Whether you're going through the grieving process yourself, or you want to be prepared to help others in their time of need, please click on the link in the description to order your copy or copies today.
As a worldview, atheism is intellectually bankrupt and is wrought with philosophical problems.
Ooh, starting off strong. And you know that if I ever said something like that about Christianity, I would be accused of being disrespectful towards other people's belief systems? It's weird how atheism seems to be the only category of religious belief, or rather lack thereof, where nobody bats an eye when it gets disrespected like that. Like, I'm not willing to even say that Christianity is intellectually bankrupt as a joke, because that gets uncomfortably close to violating YouTube's terms of service regarding hate speech. I mean, it's probably fine. Their policy is against promoting hate or violence against a protected group, not against insulting their intelligence. But given the subjective nature of how those violations are evaluated, I'm not willing to risk it. But you don't have to go far to find Christian apologists talking about the evils of not agreeing with them about the existence of God. Everything ranging from insulting our intelligence, like Matt just did, to blaming us for school shootings, like the other Matt does regularly, to accusing us of trying to indoctrinate children, which is something that most of them actually do themselves. And okay, now that I've mentioned Matt Powell and the school shootings thing, I have just two Powell clips that I feel obligated to play. The first is Matt explaining that he doesn't see anything wrong with quote mining.
Well, I don't see anything wrong with quote mining.
And next is Matt Powell explaining the real reason that school shootings happen.
Hey, the Bible says that God made us in his own image. And that's why a lot of these school shootings happen.
And yes, that is a dishonest quote mine on my part, as I already mentioned Powell thinks school shootings happen because of atheism. But since Powell doesn't see a problem with quote mining, I don't see a problem with quote mining him. Back on point, you can regularly and easily find Christian apologists not just coming close to the hate speech line when they talk about atheists, but stepping all the way over it. To be clear, I don't think that what Matt Slick just said actually constitutes hate speech or violates YouTube's terms of service, so please don't go on a mass reporting spree, but it's not hard to find content where apologists blatantly do cross that line into hate speech against atheists, and in most cases, that content just stays up.
In this video, let's take a look at the inability for the atheistic worldview to offer objective morality.
I mean, before worrying about whether or not atheism is able to offer objective morality, shouldn't we first determine whether or not objective morality exists in the first place? Why does it matter whether or not objective morality is hypothetically possible within a certain worldview if we don't even know whether or not morality is objective? Now, I will grant that on a visceral level, morality feels objective. It feels like everyone should agree with me about the things that I consider to be morally right and morally wrong. But here's the fun thing about that. Pretty much everyone feels that way. But they will also disagree about the things that they consider morally right and morally wrong. So most of us feel like our own personal moral systems should be objective, but we all have different moral systems that are often in conflict with each other. Now, sure, there are some big ticket items that are generally agreed upon, like killing, for instance, but even there will be a difference of opinion. Is killing someone in defense of your home morally right or morally wrong? Different people will answer that differently, and frequently won't even be able to comprehend opposing viewpoints. Now, what about war? Again, different people have different opinions on the morality of war, sometimes even getting down to the granular level of which specific wars were moral and which ones were not. So, aside from the visceral feeling that morality should be objective, it actually appears to be subjective in nature. And really, what would it even mean to have objective morality? Apologists will point to God as the source of objective morality, but why? Why do God's opinions on morality take precedence over our own? Because God is described by the Bible as doing things that I consider to be immoral. If God is actually the source of objective morality, how is it even possible for me to have those feelings about God's actions? Shouldn't they be obviously morally correct to everyone because they were performed by the being that is the source of morality? At the end of the day, appealing to God as a source of morality is still subjective morality. You've just decided that morality is determined on a might makes right basis. God is more powerful than us, so he gets to impose his subjective moral system onto us.
First, I need to clarify that atheists can be morally good. They can even be people of integrity.
As can Christians. They just have to borrow from secular morality in order to do it, because if they followed the moral code laid out in the Bible, they'd probably be in prison.
But that isn't the issue. Having good morals doesn't mean you have an objective moral standard.
You're right, it doesn't. And notably, saying morality comes from God also doesn't mean you have an objective moral standard. It just means that you have asserted that God's subjective moral standard is the one that we should try to follow, even when it goes against our own moral standard.
One atheist's good morals might only be coincidentally consistent with the true objective morality where another atheist isn't.
Well, same kind of goes for Christians. Take the killing in defense of your home example that I used earlier. I can tell you that at least two churches I used to attend were very much in favor of using deadly force in matters of self-defense or in the defense of one's family or home. I can also tell you that at least one of the churches I used to attend was of the pacifism at all costs persuasion, where they saw that all humans are made in the image of God, and to kill an image bearer is one of the worst crimes imaginable. So even if it means you watch them murder your entire family in front of you, you're not allowed to harm them. So even though members of all of these different churches will tell you that they got their morality from God and that it is objective morality, they disagree about their morality. How are we supposed to figure out which of them actually gets their morality from God and which does not? Now, the apologist's answer here will undoubtedly be one of two things. Either that you need to pray about it and see where the Holy Spirit leads you, or to compare the proposed morality to the morality laid out in the Bible. The problem with praying about it is that people from all of the churches that I talked about will tell you that they did pray about it, and that that is the morality that the Holy Spirit revealed to them. Apparently, the Holy Spirit just tends to agree with the person doing the praying about what is moral and what is immoral, rather than saying anything different. And then the problem with comparing it to the Bible is that biblical interpretation is a very subjective practice. You can make the Bible say whatever you want it to say. Sure, the death penalty exists in the Old Testament, so clearly it's okay to kill people who deserve it, but Jesus said to turn the other cheek, and condemned Peter when Peter tried to violently defend Jesus in Gethsemane. And there are other verses that could be used to argue either way. My point is that the Bible doesn't give us a clear moral code, and even when it tries to, it often runs counter to our moral intuition, such as when it treats rape as a property crime, where one of the potential punishments for the rapists is to be forced to marry his rape victim because it was seen as a you break it, you buy it situation rather than a violation against an actual human being.
Objective morals are those that are based outside of yourself.
Well, strictly speaking, when something is objective, what that actually means is that it is the case regardless of the presence of a mind. So if there is a rock on a beach, that rock exists independent of the minds that perceive it. If all of the minds of the universe suddenly disappeared, that rock will still be there, on that beach. So, in this hypothetical, that rock is an objective fact. It is just a fact of reality that that rock is there. Can the same be said of morality? Even when we humans call things like natural disasters evil, they are evil in the sense that they cause suffering. Remove all the minds from the equation, and it was just a bit of rock shaking for that earthquake, or a bit of wind blowing during that tornado. The hurricane that we see as the red spot on Jupiter is not evil, it's just there, existing. And if there are no minds left in the universe, then there are no beings left that could do evil things to each other. So that kind of morality ceases to exist altogether. The very existence of morality is entirely dependent on the existence of subjects. Remove the subjects, and morality ceases to exist. So morality must, therefore, be subjective. Even if God exists and is himself the standard of morality, he is a mind, a subject. The existence of morality depends on the existence of this subject. Ergo, it is subjective, by definition. Just go through the same thought process here. If you think that morality originates with God, then it cannot be objective, because if God were not to exist, then morality would not exist. So morality is dependent upon God as a subject for its existence. In order for it to actually be objective, it would have to be independent of God. It would have to be its own thing, where it does not rely on the existence of anything else. By insisting that God is necessary for morality to exist, you are necessarily saying that morality is subjective, because its existence depends on the existence of a subject.
Subjective morals are those that depend on you, your situation, your culture, and your preferences.
In other words, basically all the morals. Actually, scratch that, given the subjective nature of morality, not basically all the morals, just all the morals. So, yeah, that is what morality is, whether you like it or not.
Subjective morals change. They can become contradictory and might differ from person to person. This is the best that atheism has to offer us as a worldview.
And despite your claims to the contrary, it's also the best that Christianity can offer us as a worldview. I know you're not happy about that, and so that's why you pretend that God's existence would somehow make morality objective instead of subjective, but as it turns out, you're just wrong. And the fact that you don't like how morality actually works doesn't make it stop working that way.
Now think about it. In atheism, there is no moral right and wrong.
Morality is subjective is not the same as there is no right and wrong. Something can be wrong and subjective at the same time. In fact, as far as the big moral questions are concerned, humans do tend to largely agree with each other, and so we do things like codify those morals into a system of laws that will prevent people who disagree with them from taking those actions and punish them if they do anyway. Now, I have a prediction to make at this point. There's 4 minutes and 20 seconds left of his video. Blaze, and I bet that he is not going to actually make any arguments to support the actual existence of objective morality. He's just going to make arguments that appeal to emotion. For instance, without objective morality, there could be a scenario in which murder is not wrong. And no, he will not recognize the irony of advocating for a system where you have to call killing by two different names in order to distinguish between killing that is moral and killing that is immoral, all while complaining that atheists have a moral system where sometimes murder might not be wrong.
There is no moral should and shouldn't. Why? Well, because when you remove God, you remove the standard by which objective moral truth is established.
Ah, now that's a potentially interesting point. Because here's the thing, I've actually been slightly misrepresenting things here. I know, I'm not supposed to admit that. I'm supposed to pretend like my position is stronger than it actually is in order to win. At least, if I wanted to behave like an apologist, that's what I would do. But I've kind of been describing absolute morality here rather than objective morality. But that is an important distinction to make. Because, to again return to my example of killing versus murder, in a system of objective morality, that is a valid distinction. The idea is that any given action can be evaluated and objectively be determined to be morally right or morally wrong. Absolute morality is where one particular action is right or wrong regardless of the circumstances. So absolute morality would say that killing is wrong. Period. No exceptions. And that's where the BIC church that I went to got the idea that killing someone to defend your home or family is wrong, because killing is always wrong. So with objective morality, we don't need something saying X is wrong. What we need is a system that we can use to evaluate an action to determine whether it is right or wrong. We need an objective standard of measurement, if you will. Now, Matt claims that such a standard cannot exist without God, but the thing is, the standard is rather arbitrary. Once you have it, you can figure out whether something is objectively right or objectively wrong based on it, but what it is doesn't really matter as long as it's something that most people can agree on. Matt's standard is God, specifically the God of the Bible, which strikes me as a really bad standard to use, because then, under that system of objective morality, genocide isn't always morally wrong, slavery isn't always morally wrong, rape is sometimes just a property crime where the perpetrator has to pay the woman's father and then marry his victim in order to compensate her father for making his daughter less valuable on the marriage market. It just doesn't work as a moral system. But, I mean, as an atheist, I don't even have a standard because God doesn't exist. Well, here's the thing. God doesn't get to be the standard just by virtue of his existence. You have to explain why God gets to be the standard. And typically the explanation revolves around the fact that he created us. But that's not really an answer. You don't get to impose your moral system on people just by virtue of the fact that you created them with no rhyme or reason, just do what I say or else. So why should we use the heinous moral code that is laid out in the Bible as the standard of objective morality? I have never heard a good answer to this question. It always boils down to either, but he created us though, or might makes right. So then, what standard would I, an atheist, propose that we use? Easy. Harm reduction and pleasure maximization. And just for clarity, when I say pleasure in this context, it's kind of just a catch-all for any sort of benefit, not necessarily one that causes direct physical or emotional pleasure. Like, if I don't get murdered today, I'm not going to sit down at the end of the day and say, gee, I'm so happy that I didn't get murdered today. But I do prefer to be alive rather than dead, so when looking at the act of murder, my preference to be alive counts as an increase in pleasure for the purposes of this discussion. Same goes for harm, actually. It doesn't have to be direct, tangible, physical harm. It could just be a preference. Like, I'd rather not eat pizza today, because I had pizza for the last 5 days in a row, but it's pizza for dinner again today anyway. Pizza is still good, but because I'm not in the mood for it, we could call that harm. So, with this as the standard, we can measure the consequences of any action in order to determine whether it has caused a net increase in pleasure or a net increase in harm. Now, I use the term net increase because most actions will have mixed consequences. They will cause some harm increase and some pleasure increase. So if it causes more pleasure than harm, then that's a net increase in pleasure and vice versa. So we can say that murder is objectively wrong because the harm done to the victim is significantly greater than the pleasure that the murderer derives from the act. And we can apply this to different scenarios. Defending yourself can be morally correct, because you are protecting yourself from harm. Worst case scenario here is that this becomes a morally neutral position, where you take a life instead of having your own life taken. Tit for tat. Of course, this system isn't perfect. You could argue that something like genocide is justifiable when using this as the standard of morality, because hypothetically it is possible that the continued existence of a particular society will cause a greater net increase in harm than the increase in harm that would be caused by exterminating them. But the fact of the matter is that we can never know the hypothetical future impact of events on the scale required for making such a justification, so we should look at what we can actually see. And what we see is that genocide always seems to have a greater increase in harm than pleasure, and by a significant amount. So for all intents and purposes, genocide being wrong becomes a moral absolute in this system. Now, of course, the apologist at this point is free to say, "Aha, gotcha! You said that genocide could be a hypothetically moral action if you have enough information to determine that it would actually result in a net increase in pleasure, and yet you say God is an immoral monster for commanding and committing genocide, when God is just the kind of being who would actually have enough information to determine that it would be a net increase in pleasure. Ha, gotcha!" To which I will say, "Okay, I'll grant your point there. But in doing so, you have now admitted that it is not God that is the standard of morality, it is the reduction of harm and the increase in pleasure, and so you are now borrowing from secular morality in order to justify God's actions. If God were actually the standard of morality, you wouldn't need to do that. It would just be that genocide is okay when God commands it, because God is the standard of morality. No other reason is required." But apologists don't do that when talking about the biblical genocides. They inevitably appeal to some heinous and immoral behavior of the societies that got wiped out, in acknowledgement that our moral standard is rooted in a cost-benefit analysis rather than in God's nature.
We need to understand this was not an arbitrary ethnic cleansing. But in fact, this is a specific judgment on a morally degraded people.
God's command for Israel to drive out the Canaanites was not race-based, but behavior-based, as the Canaanites engaged in acts that would be considered criminal in civilized societies.
First, it starts off with incest, and then it goes into adultery, then it goes into offering your children to Molech, homosexual sins, and then bestiality. And we know from Canaanite primary source documents that all of these things were being practiced by the Canaanites.
He gives reasons, right? He doesn't just wake up like a mob boss and go, "Canaanites, I want them dead," right? He's got reasons for it. And probably the biggest reason, after 400 years of warning, is that the Canaanites were sacrificing their children on the molten hot god Molech, this idol.
This means that God is not required for objective morality to exist.
In atheism, morality is up for grabs. In an atheistic worldview, lying, cheating, and stealing are neither right or wrong.
Well, it depends on the context in which the lying, cheating, or stealing takes place. For instance, most people don't have a problem with the idea of lying to their kids to tell them that Santa Claus exists. A magic show is all about someone who is cheating flamboyantly, and we watch them for entertainment. They aren't immoral. And stealing is probably the easiest one on this list to justify. It's basically a trope in media to have a sympathetic character get caught stealing a necessary item, like food. And culturally, it's become socially acceptable for people to turn a blind eye when they see people stealing things like baby formula, food, or diapers. So the people that advocate for turning a blind eye in that situation would have no problem agreeing that sometimes stealing is okay. But I mean, Matt here would probably condemn all those things as being part of sinful culture. So let's see what God thinks about these things. First, there is no admonition against lying in the Bible, no rule that is just thou shalt not lie. Now, yeah, the ninth commandment is thou shalt not bear false witness, but that is arguably talking more about a legal setting where you are lying to either get someone into legal trouble or out of legal trouble. But that aside, God himself lies on occasion. Ezekiel 14:9 says, "And if the prophet is deceived and speaks a word, I, the Lord, have deceived that prophet." 2 Chronicles 18:22 says, "The Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouths of these your prophets." Jeremiah 27 says, "O Lord, you have deceived me, and I was deceived." So if God is the standard of objective morality, then lying is at least occasionally permissible. Now, how about cheating? Well, when God was wrestling with Jacob, Jacob was winning, so God cheated and knocked his hip out of his socket. Now, Fun sidebar that isn't very well supported, but I wouldn't be me if I didn't bring it up. Thigh is often a biblical euphemism for dick. So it's possible that this story has God cheating not by knocking his thigh out of its socket, but by punching him in the dick. Also, apparently the word testify has an etymological connection to the word testicle. Linguists are unclear as to the exact nature of this relationship, but one of the explanations, which is the one that I like best, so I choose to believe that it's the correct explanation, is that apparently in ancient Rome, when men were giving testimony in court, they would put their hand on their testicles and then swear by them to tell the truth, much like people do with Bibles today. The testicle thing actually seems to be more binding, if you ask me. I can't really find a great source for that story, so take it with a grain of salt, but I couldn't not mention it after reading it. Anyway, back on point, God cheated while wrestling by punching Jacob in the dick. Also, in the story of Samson, it could be said that Samson's riddle was a cheat. If you're not familiar with the story, Samson married a dirty, filthy Philistine foreigner. Samson's parents would much rather that he married one of his relatives, because that's great. But before the wedding, as he traveled back and forth from her house, at one point, he killed a lion along the way. On another day, he noticed that some honeybees had made a hive in the lion's body, so he scooped out some honey to eat as a snack on his way, just like licking it right off of his fingers like a true cultured gentleman. Fast forward to the marriage feast, and he makes a wager with the Philistines that were there. If they could solve his riddle, he'd give them a bunch of fine clothing. But if they couldn't solve it, they'd have to give him a bunch of fine clothing. The riddle was, out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet. This isn't a riddle. Without having Samson's exact life experiences up to that point, there's no way to work out what he's talking about from the riddle itself. It's akin to Bilbo's final riddle for Gollum being, "What's this in my pocket?" That was a bit of a cheat. You can't figure out the answer from the question, so it's not really a riddle. So the Philistines were, understandably, unable to solve the riddle, so they got the answer from Samson's wife. Now, up to this point, you can't even really say that God approved of this behavior from Samson. It's just a story of what happened. It's not saying that Samson was in the right here. But when he realizes that they got the answer from his wife, it says, "And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and struck down 30 men of the town and took their spoil and gave the garments to those who had told the riddle." So God's reaction to Samson's cheating at the riddle game was to help him cheat his way out of having to actually give anything up when it turned out that he lost the riddle game in spite of his cheating. So on some occasions, God is okay with cheating. Now what about stealing? Well, I mean, hell, if you just look at the conquest of the Holy Lands, people were already living there when the Israelites arrived, but God blessed the Israelites as they ran throughout the land, stealing the land and the people's possessions, and sometimes even the people themselves as slaves. So, clearly, stealing is okay with God in some scenarios.
There are phenomena to which, if the atheist so decides, moral values can be assigned.
Well, in the Christian worldview, they are phenomena that could be right or wrong depending on God's subjective opinion of the circumstances surrounding them. I don't see how that's any better. It's worse, in fact, because then you have people claiming to speak on behalf of this God, telling people to do things that, using secular moral frameworks, would objectively be wrong. But with the Christian framework, we have no way of knowing if it's right or wrong, because it depends on what God thinks of the action, and God doesn't speak for himself. So how do we know when someone who claims to speak on behalf of God is lying about it? We don't. So in the secular system, it's pretty easy to figure out the answer to most moral questions. But in the Christian system, it can be damn near impossible, because different people who claim to speak for God will say different things about the same scenario, and both will be able to back up their position by referencing scripture. The only way to really tell what is right or wrong when people who claim to speak for God are giving you conflicting information is to use secular morality to evaluate the consequences of the various potential courses of action.
Sure, the atheist might say that we all should want to help society function properly, and it does not benefit society as a whole to lie, cheat, and steal. But this is a weak intellectual argument.
And if we're being intellectually honest, it's helpful to keep in mind that the ultimate source of morality is really most likely evolution. We evolved to find certain things moral and immoral because that system of morality helped us survive and thrive. There was a benefit to us being a social species because we could work together using the various strengths and weaknesses of the various members of the society to help us prosper and thrive. In a social species like that, lying, cheating, and stealing are generally detrimental, so such behavior was selected against, and a distaste for such behavior was selected for. And because evolution works by selecting variation from a host of traits that already exist, there likely has never been, nor will there ever be, homogeneity among people and their moral opinions. There will always be bad actors who feel that their actions are morally justified, but the rest of society disagrees with that, and so will take steps to prevent them from being bad actors or to punish them for their bad actions. So at the end of the day, we can come up with all the rational systems of morality that we want, and having a good understanding of the various systems of morality is useful, but at its core, morality is just based on feelings. And this becomes apparent as we look at how morality has changed over the years. People felt differently about slavery in the past than they do today. People felt differently about killing members of competing tribes or people groups than they do today, or stealing from those different tribes. As our feelings about these things change, so do our practices. Today, if I kill someone from a different country, I go to jail. But in the time of the ancient Hebrews, we can look at the story of Phinehas to see what would happen. He murdered an Israelite man and the Midianite woman who he had in his tent with him. And God rewarded this action by stopping a plague that he had sent against Israel and offering Phinehas a covenant of peace and perpetual priesthood. So clearly, morality has changed over time as our feelings about certain issues have changed, because morality is first and foremost based on emotion. Now, as a confession, I'm not entirely comfortable with that fact, but my not liking it doesn't make it false.
Let me put some flesh and blood on this and show you why. What if there were a global economic meltdown and the social turmoil that ensued was so bad that robbing people at gunpoint to get food became commonplace?
I feel like the post-apocalyptic scenarios like that we see in the media are extremely pessimistic about the nature of humanity. Now, I might be wrong, maybe I'm just a hopeless romantic when it comes to my optimism about humanity, but I feel like it would be more common for people to band together to help each other out in these situations. But when push comes to shove, I'd honestly rather not find out.
Robbery would then be a social norm. Well then, would such a norm be wrong, or would it be right?
Well, it depends on the exact scenario surrounding this robbery, but my money's on probably wrong. Now, most likely the people who band together to help each other survive would do better than the people who resort to these tactics, meaning that such tactics would result in a net increase in harm. Ergo, they are wrong. Easy peasy. I mean, really, we need a lot more information to come to an accurate answer, but it's not like the Bible is anti certain groups of people pillaging their neighbors to steal their shit. That's literally how Israel was founded, according to the Bible.
If it is not wrong, then you affirm situational ethics, and you can't complain when the situation suits somebody else's fancy, and you get robbed at gunpoint.
Okay, now he's switching up his language here. The use of the word situational there makes me think that he's talking about absolute morality rather than objective morality. Which I kind of hope he is, because it's always fun to watch people try to defend the indefensible mess that is absolute morality.
Of course, this would lead to anarchy.
No, it wouldn't lead to anarchy. Anarchy was literally a premise of your hypothetical.
On the other hand, if you say that such a theft is wrong, well then, why is it wrong?
Harm versus benefit. Increase net pleasure, decrease net harm.
If it is your opinion that it is wrong, that's nice. But opinions don't make ethical standards.
Yeah, they kind of do, though. Even in your weird-ass system, ethical standards are based on God's opinion.
If you decide to say that it is wrong because, well, it's just wrong, well, okay, you're just begging the question.
As are you when you say it's wrong because God says it's wrong. Why does God get to determine right or wrong? And why does his determination override our own moral feelings and philosophies? It just does, I guess.
Besides, that would mean that there was a moral standard outside of yourself to which you must answer, and that would imply a moral lawgiver.
Hold up there, Sparky. You're sneaking a lot of baseless assumptions into that one little statement. It could just be that they feel it is wrong without being able to articulate why, and that's how most people go about determining right from wrong. But even if morality is external to humans, that the standard for morality is outside of ourselves, why does that mean that an entity needs to have dictated this standard? And if this entity just dictated this standard, why is that standard applicable to us? Does it also apply to the entity who dictated it? Does the fact that it has been dictated by an entity not definitionally make it subjective because it requires a subject to have dictated it? These are all questions that you need to answer if you want any of this to make sense.
Anyway, some atheists maintain that the best moral system is that which brings the greatest happiness, the least amount of suffering, and the greatest freedom for as many people as possible.
Yeah, that's roughly equivalent to the system I've laid out here, so close enough.
Well, that's a nice sentiment, but it doesn't work either.
Well, for a system that doesn't work, according to you, it does seem to be what the apologists default to when asked about God's immoral behavior in the Bible. So, given that the people who advocate for God as the source of morality have to abandon that source and appeal to this moral standard in order to defend God, I'd say that it works better than God does as the source of morality.
Take a look at slavery, for example. The greatest happiness for the greatest number of people means that a minority of people should suffer in bondage.
And that's why net pleasure and net harm are the measurements to use here. Yes, having slaves will increase the slave owner's pleasure, but the harm done to the slave who remains in bondage vastly outweighs the harm that would come to the slave owner if they were required to free their slaves. So the pleasure increase on the side of the freed slaves, even if it's only a minority of people who are enslaved, outweighs the harm caused to the slave owners who would have to free their slaves, thus justifying the elimination of the institution of slavery altogether. From the Christian perspective, however, the institution of slavery is justified, because it's explicitly condoned on a number of occasions in the Bible, both in the Old and New Testament, and it is never explicitly condemned. Side note, given our earlier discussion on the etymology of the word testify and how this is related to the word testicle, I think I'm going to start referring to the Old and New Testaments as the Old Balls Book and the New Balls Book. Back on topic, what he's trying to describe, or at least should be if he knows what he's talking about, is a utility monster. This is a hypothetical that is used against utilitarianism, which is the framework that the moral system I've proposed would fall under. A utility monster is a hypothetical monster that, to keep the terminology consistent, would gain significantly more pleasure from things that cause an increase in harm than those things cause harm, thereby causing an imbalance on the scales and meaning that anything it wants is automatically moral, even if it causes great harm. Holy shit. God is a utility monster. That actually makes a lot of sense, though it definitely doesn't make God look good. Anyway, the problem with this hypothetical is that it doesn't take diminishing returns into account. The more pleasure you have, the less pleasure you will derive from the next thing that causes pleasure. As an example, if you give $100 to someone who is struggling financially, you will cause a much greater harm reduction and pleasure increase than if you give that same $100 to a billionaire. If you just randomly drop it in a bank account, the billionaire probably won't even notice that it's there. But you can bet your ass that someone who's late on their hydro bill will notice that they've got a bit of cash, and it'll make a significantly larger impact on their life. So the more pleasure units somebody already has, the less valuable the next pleasure unit will be to them. So spreading them around as equally as possible will always be the most efficient use of them. Of course, this is talking about pleasure as if it were some discrete and finite resource when it's really not, but the same principle applies. If someone is rich enough to own slaves, then they're probably also rich enough to have a happy and successful life that doesn't rely on slaves, so they will still have an abundance of pleasure units, and the slaves that are freed will gain many more pleasure units than their former masters will lose, because they started out at a much lower point, and so haven't been affected by the diminishing returns. Also, asking for pleasure units is how I'm going to initiate sex from now on. Woman! I require more pleasure units!
No.
No.
This way, the greatest amount of freedom for the majority is ensured.
How so? Does freedom for the majority require a minority to be enslaved? I don't think that it does.
But if the atheist says that it is wrong to enslave a minority to benefit the majority, well then, why is it wrong?
Because of diminishing returns and the fact that a utility monster doesn't actually exist. Unless you believe that God exists and is the utility monster, and that's why we all have to do what he thinks is morally right or wrong. And really, that actually does fit in with a lot of what people say about God. Like, for instance, the justification for eternal torment for finite crimes is that any crime committed against an infinite being is an infinite crime. Or, to rephrase, God gets more pleasure units from infinitely torturing people who have wronged him than those people lose from being tortured. So since God is the utility monster, we need to feed the utility monster. That's the moral thing to do.
Because he said so?
No, that's your side that relies on the because he said so thing. We generally try to explain our reasoning behind stuff like that.
If he said it's wrong because the minority is suffering, well, so what? Why is suffering wrong?
Because empathy exists. I don't like suffering, so I can appreciate that other people don't like suffering either. And the existence of empathy even covers people who don't experience empathy. Because we are social creatures, and most of us do experience empathy, then for someone who doesn't experience empathy, it still makes sense to act in accordance with the rules laid out as a result of empathy, because that is the way society is structured, so they'll be better able to live the lives that they want if they don't, say, murder everyone who annoys them.
Atheism can't help us here. It just isn't up to the task of providing solid answers.
Quite the contrary, the most solid answers come from the atheistic framework, as is demonstrated when apologists need to appeal to secular morality in order to justify their God's heinous and immoral behavior. Starting to sound like a stuck record here. And so far, you, in this very video, have been unable to come up with a single example of something that my moral framework could consider morally good that goes against our feelings about morality that isn't also condoned by the Bible, at least in some circumstances. So, best case scenario here, we're on equal moral footing. But in actuality, my system wins because you have to use it to justify yours.
Let me reiterate by saying that atheism offers a subjective moral system that is based on human experience, human conditions, and human reason.
As does Christianity. It just pretends that it doesn't.
By its very nature, such moral evaluation is relativistic, dangerous, can change, can become self-contradictory, and can lead to anarchy.
Relativistic? Yeah. Changes? Sort of. It's not so much that the morality itself changes, but rather that we become aware of new factors that can affect whether or not we consider something to be moral. The rest of that? Pure baseless assertion. Like, really, the guy whose book has instructions on how to obtain slaves and instructs slaves to obey their earthly masters has no grounds for calling the moral philosophy that says that slavery is always wrong because of how much harm it causes dangerous. And as far as leading to anarchy goes, the only way that would happen is if anarchy is determined to be the political system that will cause the greatest increase in net pleasure. So if you actually understand the moral system, to claim that it will lead to anarchy is to accidentally make the claim that anarchy is indeed the political system that will cause the greatest increase in net pleasure. If that's the case, then why would you not want it? It's not like the Bible has anything to say about how the government should be structured. It just says to obey the government authorities, whatever they may be. So wouldn't you want the government that would most benefit humanity? I mean, I don't think that anarchy is that government, or lack of government, rather. Yeah. But that is the implication of what he said. So if he's being consistent, that should be the form of government that he wants.
True morality is not merely a collection of concepts agreed upon because it helps stop the guy with the gun from taking your food.
No. Apparently, it's the collection of concepts forced upon us because it helps the guy in the priestly robe take your food. That's not better, man.
There's something more, and the Bible offers us more.
The Bible offers an approval of slavery and a condemnation of eating shellfish. It's a terrible place to go for morality.
It offers us an objective set of morals. Do not lie. Do not steal. Do not commit adultery. Do not bear false witness, etc.
God lies sometimes. Why is it okay for God to lie, but not for us? How is morality objective, or rather absolute, as you seem to be talking about it, if the application of this morality happens in a relative fashion that allows God to do things that would be immoral for us? Also, it's interesting that you listed do not lie and do not bear false witness as separate items when the Bible never actually says not to lie. That's just the way some people choose to interpret the do not bear false witness commandment. Also worth mentioning is that one of the places where the Bible condones slavery is in the Ten Commandments. Those parts of the verses just get left out whenever they get quoted. The fourth commandment, to remember the Sabbath day, and the tenth commandment, to not covet, both have lists that go along with them that include your slaves. If God actually thought that slavery was immoral, then rather than having commandments telling you that you're not allowed to want your neighbor's slaves, or making sure that your slaves also get the Sabbath day off, it would have a commandment to just not own slaves. Also, if this list of rules is the objective standard of morality, then why do so many of them seem immoral or morally neutral? Like, don't make any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. So statues are immoral? All the paintings of angels and God and Jesus and all that are immoral? Technically, using a camera would be immoral with that wording, so Matt's video is actually immoral because it made a likeness of Matt, his office, his fish, which are things that are on the earth. But also, I would suggest that honor your father and your mother is relative even from a Christian perspective. Would you say to honor your father and mother if they were Muslim and wanted you to be a Muslim too? It would be dishonoring them to convert to Christianity. So this commandment is commanding you to be Muslim in that scenario. But I would wager that you wouldn't think that it was applicable in that scenario, and that the right thing to do would be to dishonor your parents by converting to Christianity.
These morals don't change depending on your opinion, your situation, or your personal preferences.
And having an immutable moral code like that is not a good thing. Because when we figured out later that slavery was wrong, we're now stuck with a moral code that says it's okay in spite of the fact that we now believe it to be not okay. And then you end up with apologists trying to soften biblical slavery to make it seem more palatable, knowing that they have to somehow justify biblical slavery while still appealing to our moral code that has come to consider slavery to be immoral. Hell, even the action of justifying biblical slavery shows the apologists to be borrowing from secular morality. They don't say slavery was okay because God said so. They try to make it seem like it was actually kind of a social welfare system, where they weren't slaves per se, they were indentured servants, and it was kind of like a system of bankruptcy, so therefore it increased net pleasure in society. I mean, they have to ignore all the verses that demonstrate the fact that this social welfare type of slavery was specifically applicable to Hebrews only, with any non-Hebrews being regular old immoral chattel slaves, but they still try to justify it by appealing to secular morality, not biblical morality.
They're based on God's character, and since God does not change, these morals don't either.
Except when they do. You can actually see the morality of the ancient Hebrew culture changing in the Bible itself. In Exodus, for instance, the nice form of slavery, so to speak, is specific to Hebrew men, leaving us with the impression that the women are chattel slaves. In Deuteronomy, though, it explicitly includes women in this gentler form of slavery. In the Old Balls book, Old Testament, polygamy is the norm and is never condemned or forbidden. In the New Balls book, it isn't outright condemned, but it does seem to be frowned upon, with one of the requirements for certain church leadership positions being that they have only one wife and that they are their wife's only husband. So we can see that biblical morality did not remain consistent throughout the writing of the Bible. And then if we study church history, what the church considers moral also continued to change. If Matt here went back in time a few centuries, the church authorities of the time would look at him the same way that he looks at progressive Christians who are accepting of things like gay marriage or the existence of trans people today. Go back far enough, and he could even be put to death for heresy. Now, I'm sure he'll attribute this to human misunderstanding of God's perfect moral system, but since God never bothers to come down and clear any of this stuff up himself, I fail to see how that solves the problem.
Therefore, it is always wrong to lie, always wrong to steal, to commit adultery, and to bear false witness.
I dare say that Matt is of the variety of Christian who would say that it is morally wrong to lie to a Nazi in order to hide a Jew. Now, in my view, that's a pretty clear-cut example of when it would be most definitely morally good to tell a lie. Hell, the Bible even agrees with me on this. Rahab is, in the New Balls book, referred to as being a person of faith and good works. What good works did she do? She lied to the soldiers of Jericho to protect the Jewish spies, allowing them to complete their mission. Now, why would the Bible use her as an example of someone who does good works when the only works she is said to have done are prostitution and lying to protect the spies? Are prostitution and lying not wrong in your view? Well, you just said that lying is never morally right, so I guess prostitution is morally right, and she was one hell of a good prostitute.
But not so in atheism's empty moral vacuum, because morality is formed in a subjective manner in atheism.
I mean, I've already thoroughly addressed this, so at this point, I'm just going to resort to schoolyard tactics. No, you!
So, let me ask you, after an economic meltdown, when an armed stranger is approaching you in the dark on a road, and you're taking food home to your hungry family, who would you rather the stranger be? A Christian who believes stealing is wrong and that God is watching? Or the atheist who sees a need and points his gun at you as he adapts his ethical situation to suit the moment?
Well, given the fact that I'm an atheist, and given the history that Christianity has of being completely willing to do harm, up to and including killing non-Christians, I mean, just look up the Crusades sometime if you don't believe me, I'd prefer if that person were an atheist. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Remy Schmidt, who says, Netherlands here. Dik and hout are two Dutch words meaning thick, as in too thick to break by hand, and wood, as in wooden plank. A lot of American and Canadian words are derived from European non-English words of the original settlers. Okay, this makes that Dik out road thing so much better, because now not only does it sound dirty because, you know, Dik out, but it literally means thick wood. I love it. Thanks for watching. Don't forget to go to the link in the description to order your copy of Sometimes Illness Wins. Thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon and sponsorships manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, Rick Klein and all the rest, who are the secular morality that gets borrowed by the Christian apologists that is my channel. If you'd like to be used to justify immoral actions while simultaneously claiming that the immoral actor is actually the ultimate source of all morality, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my P.O. Box address is in the description. See you next time! Woman, I require more pleasure units.
No.
No.
Father, this child.
Love you, Lily.
I love you too, but you're kind of annoying sometimes.
Sometimes?
Let me rephrase that. Sometimes you're not annoying.
Okay, that's better.